this show is not for the easily offended. So if you are easily offended, go listen to something else.
Well, sometimes we're like locked into our book circle, and then we don't talk about comics in general or certain things. We only talk about our books. Like Marvel Noise is a lot more all encompassing than indie.
That's because I put more effort into Marvel Noise, and this I let all of us contribute to, and you guys don't pull your weight. You guys got to step up and take the reins.
Welcome to Indie Comic Book Noise, episode 379. We are here to represent independent comics. And who are we, you ask?
I was going to say we hate Image this week, since Phil hated Marvel last week.
Aww.
I think we hate Image this week.
Wouldn't it hurt more if we said we hated Zenoscope or something? Wouldn't that get Phil more in the sweet spot?
Puppet Master said he hasn't read it for a few years.
What?
Yeah.
How long have we been doing this podcast?
I don't know. Maybe it was just a thing, and then he started this podcast, and then he grew up. I'm not quite sure what happened.
Well, at any rate... 379 is a lot of issues to go through, but it's me, Andrew, the LA Rabbit, also joined by WX Kev in Canada. Say hi, Kev.
Hey.
And Super Steve Raker from the Bunker.
Hooray. Reading indie comics again, having the time, delving in, enjoying what I'm coming across.
You're another Kickstarter, Steve?
Not tonight.
Ah.
Sadly, we are Phil-less tonight. We hope you had your fill of Phil, because you'll have to wait till the next time.
You know, but what we carry on. Is that he had to go... watch a movie, a struggling movie from one of those corporate companies.
Hmm.
Yeah. Well, we all know Phil's a huge fan of Marvel Comics, so I would imagine it's something about the House of Ideas, if I had to guess. But we're here.
Of bankrupt ideas, am I right?
We're here to talk about indie comics and where the independent comic book noise podcast, sponsored by no one, part of the Deliberate Noise Network, with a Facebook fan page. I'm told these things exist. I am not on the Facebook personally, but if you are, please go check it out. We post things there. It's lots of fun. There's a whole community, I'm led to believe. Also, I am on the Twitters, as is the podcast, at Indie Comic Book N. I am LA_Rabbit1. Kevin is WXKev. Super Steve Raker is not at Super Steve. It always trips me up when I'm trying to tweet to you. I'm like, it should be Super. Instead, it's Steve Andreski. And Phil is me and my sloth.
Right on.
And let's get cooking into the books. So, as is host duties, I'll flip the script and let Super Steve get the first crack at the books.
Did you guys ever read any of Winter World from IDW? It's a Chuck Dixon book.
Because I'm like a big distinguished competition Chuck Dixon fan, but I haven't.
And, no, Andrew, I don't mean like the... We've done some winter things. We've done like the Snowpiercer. We've done... But I don't know. Did you or Phil bring this book up in the past?
I know it might have been some other pot. I think it, but we're talking way in the way back machine here.
Well, I read the volume one collection, which collects issues 1 through 4, which is written by Chuck Dixon and drawn by none other than Butch Geis.
Wow.
And the title is Winter World. It's from IDW, and the first collection is entitled La Nina. And which is funny reading this, given this odd winter where there's a lot more rain and warm weather than the cold and snow that we experienced last year because of the La Nina and El Nino and all that sort of business going on. This story is like a post-apocalyptic landscape where no one alive has any recollection of any other world than one that's covered, like, in snow and ice. All right? So it's been a while.
And so it's basically like you in Albany.
Yeah. Not this winter. So, and we get introduced to, like, a adolescent, maybe a 20-year-old type girl, you know, scrappy, you know, the type, survivor, and a guy who she, no romantic interest, it's more of a paternal kind of a relationship, who's a another survivor type. They're considered wasters. They're just trying to survive and get by, and they're companions. And we see some of the threats of this world, scavengers, other people trying to take your resources, your supplies, and trying to find food, and the wild animals that are still alive, and the tables have been turned as far as the food chain is concerned. But the storyline's kind of cool. It's got that Road Warrior type futuristic vibe where you know, resources are precious, especially things like fossil fuels. And this fellow happens to have a truck that runs, and he knows how to mix different chemicals and liquids to make fuel that this engine will run on. And he knows how to keep the engine up. And it's a lost art. Not only do most people not have or see any vehicles, but to know how to run an engine and take care of it and maintain one is pretty unique in this world, we're led to believe. So they're on the run, and they come across, on the edge of the water, a slope-type community that's built into the slope of this shore. And it's all green, and it's like terraced farms and stuff. And they can't believe it. They've never seen anything like this. They only heard of plants and crops growing. And, of course, they trip up some trap that shows that they have, you know, come upon the property. And the villagers and the people who run this community are ready to take these two out. We don't need two more hungry mouths kind of a thing. But the fact that this guy's got a truck is really intriguing to the leader, and he's like, all right, you've got some worth here, especially if you know how to run an engine and maintain it and stuff. So they end up with like a tenuous having the arms open to this village and this community, so you get to learn a little bit more about how things work and stuff, and it's pretty cool. And what they do is they use the La Nina warm weather of the water, and it's just enough to keep things warm so that they can grow their crops and have like mass production and store enough food for the couple of years until the next cycle when the warm water comes again, which is, it was just pretty neat.
And so you're describing my daily northern life.
You do have a lot of lakes around you. But they don't, like, fully trust that they're really being told everything, and so there's all that, and things get revealed, and betrayals, and all that business, and it turns out that they also like to sacrifice someone for the warm weather return promise to their false god or whatever. So then the girl becomes the potential victim, and it's pretty cool. They send her with a bell on her neck to walk out on the ice and just keep walking. And it's like to call a killer whale that has sort of been trained to know to hear the bell and to come. So she's like running from this killer whale that's swimming under the ice and coming up and breaking out. And I did say it was drawn by Butch Geist, you know, so it's pretty sweet. There's a really funny twist, too, I got to add as well, is the reason that they're into this guy's truck. He's like, well, where do you want to go? He's like, go. We don't want to go anywhere. This is the place to be. But what they want to do is to create a greenhouse effect so that more the ice will melt and more green lands will grow. They want more carbon dioxide in the air. They want the engine. They just want an engine to perpetually run to produce pollution to create a greenhouse effect. And this is their religion. And it's because they found part of a book. And they take the book out, and it's Al Gore's book.
Oh.
So they're like into this whole extremist global warming type thing, and you know, it's very naive, but they're powerful, so they end up being sort of the bad guys, and there's a big chase. And I found the first volume to be really enjoyable. The second volume I haven't read, but I have, and the artist isn't Geis, boo-hoo, but it is Tomas Giorello, the guy who's the Beast on those Conan stories that Tim Truman draw write. So I'm really looking for. That's not going to be a sacrifice at the art helm at all. I expect the second volume to be just as beautiful. I can't wait to get into it because it was fun. It was a light enough concept that you could just sort of read through it and not have to flip back pages and or keep anybody's name straight or any. I didn't worry about that. I just plowed right through it, and with it just being the two protagonists, it read quite well.
So you're not going to put a bell around the second volume and push it out under the river?
No, not at all. Tomas Giorello, man, I can't wait to see his take on this stuff.
You made me think of two comic titles with this, which sounds good. Like the Image series that just came out, Snowfall. They have like weaponized weather and stuff like that. I don't know. I guess the easiest snow things, like as my mind goes to. Or then it's funny that I guess a lot of people like doing riffs on Road Warrior and all that type of stuff anyways.
Sure.
But like Bloodshot's currently in from Valiant is currently in an arc where it's something like that, like, you know, scarce resources, trying to fix a truck to get water and everything. And it's funny, the arc just before the current one was drawn by Butch Geis as well. So that's probably why my mind went to that one.
What you been reading?
Some wrestling comics, which may seem a little weird, because I don't think I've proclaimed myself at any time as someone that takes part in a lot of wrestling stuff. But I guess there was two points in my my life where I was watching wrestling. I guess it was the closest thing to like real life superhero stuff. So, you know, I when you're a kid, you're kind of like, ooh, wrestling. And then later on, I guess it was in high school when it was, I guess they would call it the Attitude Era. Where when I first got on the internet, like a lot of people seemed to be into wrestling, and I followed it for a while.
I think most people have a wrestling. When you're a kid, there's something about like jumping up on a couch and jumping on someone else that seems so fun and exuberant. I know I used to have my share of I couldn't lift people up, but you know where you jump up on the couch and you jump on top of people like you're a big time wrestler.
I was completely on the outside of the kids who watched the wrestling and were into the wrestling and stuff throughout my life. That never really got into the wrestling, although I did watch it for a while. I guess it would have been early 2000s or something when Stacy Keibler was one of the female wrestlers. So I somehow flipped through the channels and caught a glimpse of her and kept coming back for more.
I was out of wrestling by then, but I am familiar with her work with the elves. I enjoy those cookies.
You can see my comic book superhero, you know, idea. Like I like that type of costumes coming through when I was watching the wrestling, though, because I'm like, I like the guys obviously that were in the costumes rather than the guys that were just like in their underwear. I'm like, well, that's more boring. I want more outlandish stuff.
Sure.
Like I wanted guys that had wore masks and long hair and crazy costumes and where there was fire coming up from the stage and, you know, that type of stuff, like the Undertaker and everything. But the comic I'm talking about is from Oni Press, and I got it in a special bundle, which I don't think is available anymore on Comixology. Like the volumes are available individually. Like there's two volumes of Super Pro KO. which is their league, by Jarrett Williams.
Well, I think this was discussed on the now-defunct Earth 2 podcast by John Westhoff.
Oh, that's good.
Many years ago.
But it's a little just
context for you. I feel bad that their show folded, so we're going to give them some love.
Now we feel bad. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Right now.
But anyways, this had like the two volumes in a bundle, and I forget where I'd heard of this series before. Probably from other wrestling fans, because you know how I guess you think of like licensed comics, like wrestling comics, like they're not that good, even though like Steve Ditko might have worked on them for early Valiant before they are like into much superhero stuff. But you know, you think of like, oh, how's someone gonna do like a wrestling comic? But I think this is like the perfect match, because it goes into like I think all the stuff you would want to see. Like half of it is like the matches, and the other half is like the life behind the life of like wrestling, where like the guys are getting drunk behind stage, or there seems to be some other unrevealed like element of some nefarious dudes in the background. Like, I don't know if it's just because the managers and the corporate overlords seem shady, or if they would actually bring in some other, like, aliens are running the wrestling ring or something. But it seems like it's certainly possible, because they have to, like, they go through all the stuff you would see on camera and off camera. So they have their storylines, but they also have the storylines behind, where like, oh, well, we have this new guy coming in, and he's, like, pulling in greater numbers with the fans or whatever, so we're going to have to let someone go, and, you know, we don't have enough money to pay for everyone. So, like, the corporate overlords are like, yeah, cut this guy that's been with us for a long time and everything. So you're like, they seem more sinister, like there could be more to them. But you basically follow this a guy named Joe. It's not funny.
Just a guy named Joe.
He's like went to some kind of like wrestling college type of thing to learn how to wrestle, and he's like coming in. So he's like our point of view character to the show, and he's like being introduced to like his idols and things like that, and he's trying to get. He's getting paid like, for the first time, and he's having his first matches, and he's finding out about all this other stuff that's going on at the wrestling ring, and you know, everything like that. They have a lot of cool stuff though, so I think it perfectly encapsulates like everything that wrestling is. It's in black and white, and it's like fairly cartoony and everything. I would say it's pretty close to being something like what I would expect from some kind of Japanese manga too.
Wow.
So
I can see you're definitely the link between wrestling and superheroes, like you say. With also there's like the bombast, like wrestlers are always talking a lot of exaggerated language in addition to their exaggerated physiques, and the action and everything's heightened to a nonsensical degree.
Yeah, and they're even like naming their moves and everything like that. And there's just it's funny. Like you think of other exploitive things that they might do in wrestling with women, but they actually do it with like a sumo wrestler in here, where like a double page spread is like the sumo wrestler from behind. So it's just funny when they have certain shots like that. You're just like, whoa, I don't know if I need to see that exactly. And then, you know the whole thing where you always try to distract the referee, like, oh, I'm going to do something I'm not supposed to be doing. So when you have the tag team matches, you're going to just distract the referee so you can break up the chair or whatever. So I thought it was really neat, like seeing the... Like, you get to the fast-paced matches, and then you get all the words and the craziness when, like, you find out the story behind everyone's life.
Well, I was going to take us to the heady days of 2011.
Oh.
As the aftermath of the flood continues, I'm going through all these old books and found this one that I picked up from the creator himself.
So can you predict how many weeks of flood coverage we're gonna have?
Probably 2016 is going to be the year of Andy.
It'll be the year of the flood.
And the creator, this is his book, his debut as the soul, as the main guy from 1996. And the creator is Steve Olaf, the famous colorist. And the book is Armature. He had his own press, Olioptics, as the company. And it's this... his description is, Armature is completely innocent, worldless, without a clue. In his veins burns the power of an unbridled truth, a flexible power guaranteed to get him into trouble as fast as it helps him get out of it. And the design is kind of like, imagine sort of a balloon animal skeleton that's humanoid, but he has kind of projections out of the skull that look almost like dog ears, and there's no mouth or nose but two eyes, and he's almost like a liquid texture to him. So the design is definitely eye-catching. And Steve Olaf was a pretty well-known colorist who had colored a tons of books, and this was his break into it. And the character is kind of odd, and it's a series of vignettes that tell his adventure, but he doesn't speak, so the characters all have to talk at him, and it's his reaction. Like I said, he's almost, I'm going to say kind of dog-like. Sometimes he's on all fours. He's definitely a humanoid, but you get that feeling of, like, I think that kind of innocence and the truth-telling part of it, and also the lack of speaking helps. But there's a map in it, which I knew Kevin would appreciate.
Ooh,
yeah. And a little... text story at the back, and then a couple of letters in the thing as well. And Steve was nice enough to sign this for me. And what? There's a the Max appears in it. Sam Keith's character.
Wow. Huh. Is that in continuity or?
It's credit, you know. It's he's given the copyright and everything. I would presume that he, Sam Keith, was aware of it. I don't know. Maybe this was some sort of surprise or whatever. But
that's kind of cool, though, that, you know, when those kind of things happen in the crossover.
Yeah, and Olaf's artwork is pretty. It mimics Keith without the kind of excessive ink and splashes and scratches. But it's clearly the Max. You know what I mean? There's no doubt, and it looks like. He's got the over-exaggerated musculature as well. He just doesn't have all the, I guess, noodling for, that's not really the right word, but you know how Sam Keith has all those extra splashes and lines and everything. But that got me to my bigger question as I was trying to think how to describe this. As I mentioned earlier, ironically enough, John Westhoff, I know, is a big Sam Keith Max fan, so I tweeted if he needed this issue, I would send it to him. Because the Max is in it, but I didn't... Now, how do you describe... Okay, so the Max is in it for 2.5 pages. And I felt that cameo wasn't the correct term. But guest appearance doesn't seem right. Crossover, like, what are the levels of a character appearing in another book?
Well, it's not a cameo.
Yeah, cameo is like a page.
Yeah, maybe a panel.
And they don't interact, or that maybe it's like, hey, how are you? Like, it's a real brief thing.
I'd say it was a guest appearance, but not a guest star.
Yeah.
He appeared in the book,
and he interacts with him. But it is like, it's not even 2.5. It's 2 pages, and then one panel on the next page. But it's like, this is, there needs to be an official, like, grading system for how you describe character appearances. Because it's certainly not a crossover in any way. I mean, it is. Well, and that's the other thing. He does interact. The two characters meet, and Max gets kind of angry and kind of goes after, chases him a little bit, but he gets tired and gives up.
Yeah.
And that's the extent of it.
I always think of a crossover as being more when the story continues between the books.
Yeah.
That's crossing over. Otherwise, it's just a guest appearance or a guest star or, at the very least, the cameo. Like the... Well, I won't say on this podcast.
Well, what?
Yeah, what, like, Like a cameo would more be like when you see those funeral scenes like in Savage Dragon or something, and it's like everyone from the Image universe is there, but they're not really interacting a whole lot.
Sometimes from the Marvel and DC universe too, and some of those big group shots from Ben Larson yeah. does. But also, you know, like Mike Allred has that kind of open invitation for people to be able to use Madman. So quite often we see guest appearances or guest starring roles for Madman in other people's books.
I always think of the classic, and it was the first issue of, and they touted like, you know, Turtles are in the book. And it was the preteen Dirty Jean Kung Fu Kangaroos number one. And it really is like a literally a panel that they're in. And they're like, this is it. This is the appearance. And I was like, yeah, that's the cameo where it's a marketing right. gimmick and they appear on it. But Olive's got a great way, like without a character that speaks and with kind of a basic form, he manages to evoke a lot of expression. I mean, clearly the eyes are the key thing because you can widen them and narrow them and the kind of flexible, bony skeleton nature. And the character, so like I said, the other characters interact with him, and but I kind of like him, but I don't think much. My research at the show, I think it went on for like two or three issues, and that was the extent of the armature run. But if you're a max completionist, as Mr. Westhoff I think might be, he will be receiving this comic as I drop it in the mail. But I want to talk about armature. Number one from Ollie Optics. Like I said, he signed it. As of 2011, he had a few of these left. If you run into him, you should be able to get one off him. It's got a little pin-up in the back. And I don't know. I think it was an interesting design. Also, mid-90s, so the story really isn't super plot-heavy. It's more sort of experiential. But if you like that kind of... It reminds me also of Disney is big on kind of the silent sidekick. They always have one talky kind of sidekick and then one kind of quiet pantomiming one.
I picked up a self-published book through the Comixology submit banner, I guess you would say, a couple weeks ago from the self-titled Insane Comics, and it's called Night of the Fire Beast. With story and art by Chris Martinez and script by Jonathan Claude. And you can find more information at dorugan.com, dorugan.com. And what Night of the Fire Beast is it's a one-shot, but it seems like it could set the ground for other future one-shots, and there's a kind of a coming attraction for another potential issue at the end, but I can't tell if it's part of the joke, because what it is it's a parody of a 1950s giant monster movie, like a kaiju type monster movie, but the comic is the film, and there's an editorial page on the first page that explains that this was the film that was never released, and that the director was, you know, cut all these corners expense wise and he just wanted to, he was like the Martin Goodman of films, he wanted to just capitalize on whatever the latest trend is and throw up a whole bunch of product that was that trend and ride the wave until it wasn't financially successful anymore, and kind of with an anybody can do this crap type attitude. And it's a black and white issue, and because it's the film itself, subtly in different panels you can see guide wires holding up the tails of the kaiju, or a little, you know, 2x4 in the corner of a set piece, or the shadow of a boom mic that would accidentally appear in some of the shots, and none of this hits you over the head with it as you're reading through the story. And it's a very cliched type story. The guy's on the boat and they come upon a island and discover giant kaiju like creature and have to escape with their lives, and the one kaiju encounters another one, so then this is the big battle between these two giant creatures as the humans are trying to escape, and the one is like Triceratops-like and the other one is Godzilla-like, and so that's a lot of fun. And it was a nice vibe of those old cheap horror films that I grew up with and certainly love. And it was a fun experiment to see them producing the one shot in with this structure. There's a few pinups in the back as well. It was a good read. Night of the Fire Beast.
And how did you come across that, Steve? Sorry,
just the cover is not black and white. The cover is red and black and white with a lot of red. And as I was on Comixology, just flipping through the new submit, indie submissions, came across it, and the price was right. And when I clicked on it and read the description, it seemed clever, and it turned out to be. What was cool was that it was sincere. As I was reading through it, it wasn't taking advantage of its cleverness. And like I said, it wasn't hitting you over the head with it. It wasn't trying to be funny. It was sincere. And it was, but therein lies the joke.
Good. I always like, you're quite adventurous on the Comixology submit.
You know,
you're willing to roll the dice on stuff.
If it's not an expensive book, yeah. I mean, these guys who do the 99-cent or $1.99 type thing, and you're going to try the new, if the art looks good and or the concept seems particularly interesting, yeah, that's my version of you walking up and down Long Beach, hitting everyone's booths.
Yes, that was this. I guess I should maybe talk a little bit quickly, not to step on Kevin's toes, but the Long Beach Expo just happened this weekend. And it was quite nice.
Yeah, you're back to a con a weekend or something this weekend again?
Well, I went very restrained. I'm on kind of a cutting back what I'm spending. So I only had one big purchase, and I broke down and got my first IDW Artifact Edition. Normally I stick to the Artist Edition, which are characterized by more complete issues, and the Artifact are just scattered pages. But it was the old Star Wars, the original Marvel adaptation of the Star Wars books. And for those of you that have listened to any of my appearances, you know I'm irrationally fond of those because they were one of my early gateway drugs into comics and reading. I took to the first Star Wars movie very strongly. Both the movie, the toys, all the accoutrement. And that included the comics. And that was a way to get me to enjoy reading. And so just to see those pages, I was willing to bow. And it was $100. I mean, I know you're like, $100 is a lot. But for those artist editions, $100 is not. That's on the cheap end. Those things go. Like, for instance, they had a special cover. And that was like $150. And I'm like, $50 for a different cover seems crazy. But, well, $100 is a lot. You also have to remember it's basically full reproductions of the art pages, and it's an entire giant book of them.
It's worth the $100 to just be like taking this folder of original art home to be able to look at it at your own, you know, at your own speed. And I really like those a lot. It's funny. I was just feeling really nostalgic about Star Wars, that era of Star Wars first coming out and the merchandising that went along with it. I came across on Amazon Prime. I don't know if it's on, Netflix as well, but there's some documentary about Star Wars toys, and it's was like an hour long maybe, and I only watched the first part of it, but it was really enjoyable, and hearing those old Kenner guys talking about the information they got from the movie and doing the original sculpts and the whole ghost promotion where you got the box that promised you the figures at the beginning. I was one of those kids, so it was just really entertaining, and to see they would watch, be invited to see like early viewing of the movie, and they would bring their cameras and just click pictures of things during the movie, anything they think they might want to make a toy out of, and coming up with their strategies. And I found it very entertaining since I was on the consumer side of that so strongly, like you were. We were exactly the right age, you know, Andrew?
Those toys have a special, even though toy manufacturing has come mercifully a long way, and it's much better now. I mean, don't get me wrong, my nostalgia for the size and everything, the current flexibility and options, and generally the sculpts are all better than they were back then, but there's something magic about taking those elements of your childhood. And also for me, it was comics really were the gateway to reading. And I ended up being a voracious reader. But without comics, I don't, you know, there's plenty of people that don't read anything. And I very well was headed down that path. So I always owe a little something to comic books and
Star Wars.
Absolutely.
I was reading Goodbye Kindergarten because of comic books.
So, because I had a poor kindergarten experience, so I think that it put me off schooling in general. Never know why that woman went into teaching. Why would someone who hates humanity? Well, that's a side topic for here and there. But I thought I was going to escape with only that. But the Aftershock guys were there. Uh-oh. And they were doing a special 3 for $10. So I picked up a few 3 issues of that. But was it.
Did we steer you in the right direction, Andrew?
I split the baby because you and Phil were so disagreeing on everything. I did some for you and some for Phil. So Insects.
Yes.
The Garth Ennis book. And then the Jimmy Palmy and Amanda Connor. They were there at the show. We always go to their panel. It's always strange when people bring their kids there, but hey, why not? They're always very frank. And they both talk about how they like doing the panel. They ask people who have unusual jobs, and I think that's helped stimulate some of their creative juices because they always mention how this will all end up working its way into comic plots later on. Because there were people in the crowd that worked. One was a magician's assistant. Another was like an intern at a special effects company, and all these, another one made all these funny, like, dog costumes and everything. So, but other than that, we just went the one day. It's a lot of catching up with friends, walking the alley. I lingered over, but I have to be good. I got to clean up this mess first. But that ecstatic omnibus was $40, and I almost walked away with it. But I just.
I bought that for $40 like a few years ago when it seemed like they were being liquidated.
I mean, it's a really good deal. It's just that I've got so much here that I got to get through and straighten out. So, well, hopefully I'll be able to stay on the straight and narrow and clean it up. But yeah, the Long Beach Expo, it's fun. There's always a ton of cosplay. I also didn't buy any toys. I was sorely tempted by the Marvel Legends Whirlwind and Taskmaster. But when you actually look at the Taskmaster, it's not Parks and Cons on Twitter. Sean Marshall bought the Taskmaster. I don't know. I like the figure, and I like the character. I'm not super impressed with the sculpt.
Ditto.
I don't know if you guys have bought it yet.
Yeah, I've got it. It's the armored version. I'm looking at it right now.
I don't think they've hit mass retail in Canada yet.
But the Whirlwind, I'm probably going to break down at some point.
It's a great figure.
I was just like, no.
Buzzsaws come off. They're like on a little nipple that they stick onto, so you can take the little buzzsaws off and like make them as if they're shooting out at somebody.
Andrew sent me.
That guy, although I may have actually burned out his little action figure action because I was playing with him too much. Some of those old toys weren't toy biz, maybe not the most durable. Also, something happens to the plastic on those things. They get kind of gummy or whatever. Have you touched any of those ones that are from the 90s? Like, I have the Prowler and everything, and there's like some, I don't know what's on them or if it's the petroleum breaking down.
Exactly. They're starting to decompose.
Yeah.
That's only happened to I don't think any of my Marvel Legends, but only like certain things, like maybe like a few Legos or something. Like, it hasn't happened to all of my stuff from 90. But as you know, it's also funny that Toy Biz, they put out like an indie comic line too at one point in time when they were just like they had Lord of the Rings, they had the Marvel, like it seemed like they were putting out everything, like Sin City stuff and like Conan and
Madman. Didn't they have a Flaming Carrot character?
I'm not sure.
I remember seeing one. I don't know if it was Toy Biz, but somebody had a Flaming Carrot figure. All these things are just. Well, I was in the 99-cent store, and they had HeroClix. They had the Lord of the Rings HeroClix at the 99-cent store. But anyways,
that was a sink.
I hijacked poor Kevin's spot and jumped jumped the queue. So bad, Andy. I'll turn the pass the mic back to Kevin.
Not only did you do that, you went off on a Marvel tangent.
Hey, IDW Star Wars is IDW.
Dark Horse Star Wars too, at some point. So
yes,
it's all good, right?
It's all comics.
Well, I'm gonna go into the vertical direction. No one's gonna get that joke. The company's Vertical Incorporated. Huh. Anyhow.
Don't humor him, Steve. I have to now fill in for Phil, for criminy's sake.
But I think everyone pretty much knows like your Tokyo Pop and your Viz Media and your stuff like that. But there's some smaller publishers of stuff from Japan as well and other countries, like maybe some Korean stuff or what have you, that have all their own names that I can no longer remember. But, yeah, Vertical is one of the good smaller companies where I think, like, maybe 75% of their stuff, like, I'm like, ooh, I'm interested in that. Like, they put out a lot of good stuff. But, this is what I mentioned on the previous episode with this Cheese Sweet Home by Konami Kanada, which is this cat comic because, you know, in Japan, they have a comic for everything. So, of course, they would have a cat comic, right?
And you love cats.
I know. I have a cat. So, like, that automatically, it's sort of like the whole rabbit thing you have. Like, how can you say no? Like, you look at it, you're like, ooh, cute cats. So, this is the beginning of I think it's like 15 volumes. It's many volumes, though, of just cats going around. And, you know, again, it's your typical cat stories. Like, I don't think there's anything too shocking in here. I'll say how the cat gets his name. Like, he gets lost, and then these other family, like, sort of takes him in, even though they're not supposed to have cats, but they don't really have a name for him. But they keep on, every time he goes to the bathroom, this kid keeps on saying, chi. And you figure out that chi and pee are sort of like the same thing, so they call the cat chi, but you're really calling the cat pee. I don't know if this is a Japanese thing, but I thought that was a little weird. But I gotta bring something weird to this podcast, hey, every week.
Japanese, right? And cats, that's you all over. It
just reminds me that I gotta read some more Fat Freddy's Cat for next episode. We forgot, Andrew.
But the cat's really expressive in here, and I guess it's kind of surprising that it's not in black and white. It's like in these pastel colors. So it's like really nicely colored and everything. So if like black and white was like a turnoff, like this is really well done. Like there's a lot of white, but a lot of colors. Really colorful and everything, and this cat going through all these adventures. But what's disturbing, and I had to look it up as soon as I read the first volume to see if a particular story thing continued, because this cat speaking in, like, well, thoughts. I shouldn't say speaking, you know, it's sort of like Garfield-like, in the, you sort of hear these cat's thoughts, that's like broken English type of weird type of English stuff. And apparently that sort of like goes away later on because they're like misspelling words and everything. So if kids are like reading this, they would be like, oh, I'm gonna, you know, spell the words this way, and they'd be like totally wrong. The other really weird thing is, since this cat is lost and adopted by another family, it keeps on like finding something to entertain itself, like, oh, a ribbon, I'll play with a ribbon. And then it's like, wait a second, I want to go home since I'm lost. And then it'll go, oh, a leaf. Oh, I'll play with this leaf. Or, oh, I got to go to the litter box. And then it'll go, I think I'm forgetting something. Yeah, my mother really loves me and I'm lost. And then it starts crying, but then it forgets. It like goes on and on. And you're like, hey, this is a fun cat story. And then it just gets really depressing because you're like, oh, yeah, this cat's lost and just wants to go back home to its mother. So apparently they dropped that plot line after the first volume because I had to know if this weird fun, depressing angle would sort of like continue, because it sort of interrupts your enjoyment of the story going, yeah, this cat should really get home. Like this cat's crying all the time. Like, that's not conducive to you having fun with a cat story.
The cat did not come back the very next day.
So I guess the cat just forgets that about his mother and everything, and just, you know, just has adventures after, rather than going, yeah, I'm not home.
Well, I guess it's supposed to represent that it doesn't have the attention span or focus of a person.
Yeah. But, like, it would be better if they had, like, if the cat was, like, it sort of evokes that thing when, like, someone has a lot of cats and they give one away, and then the cat's, like, at your house or whatever, and it's, like, meowing or whatever, and you think if it's wondering about where it used to live and why its brothers and sisters aren't around anymore, and then it just forgets about that and just, you know, takes over your house and orders you to do things, and it controls your life, and it that's its house now, and it just doesn't think about that other stuff anymore, you hope.
So he gave him to a woman going up in a balloon. The balloon went down 90 miles away.
The cat came. Yeah, it's easy to get distracted by cat stories. I feel like I'm part cat in that instance. But I have something from my trip to my one visit to the New York City Comic Con, which where I met Steve in the flesh for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Super Steve. He is real, not just a voice on your computer. If there was any doubt. And one of the things I picked up was I visited The Witch Hunter, Monarch Comics. And not only did I pick up his issues, but he had a copy of the Strange Eons magazine. Issue 1 from spring of 2010. And you can go to strange.eons.com. The magazine is still going on. They're up to issue 19. And they still have issue 1 in stock. So if you're interested, you can pick this one up. But what it was they'd been running sort of a Lovecraft inspired magazine that went out of business, Planet Lovecraft magazine, which I hadn't heard of, and so they decided to take that and start this Strange Eons magazine, which they say their inspiration is like eerie and creepy and all those types of heavy metal. So it's an anthology comic. It's black and white, and they have a bunch of, like, some serial and some one-shots. So the first one is The Isle of Cthulhu, which has a guy, and he shipwrecks and finds this Cthulhu-like idol, and it's at the bottom. But the reason I got it was the Witch Hunter story in here. And what I like is it's done with the black and white and the gray tones. And I think that really works for Witch Hunter. I mean, the Witch Hunter, the books themselves are in color. A while ago, I tweeted Frank Bruner did the knife, that cover I loved, number 6. And I tweeted out a picture of it. And I always thought that was really clever to go find some famous comic guy to do your cover. But, yeah, so it's a funny time-traveling the story based on The King in Yellow, where this Witch Hunter, the Witch Hunter character himself, he is immune to magic in a certain way, and he hunts these witches. And so a character back in time leaves him notice that he'll have to come back in time. He has his device that lets him track down magic to save it. And it's just a clever, like, it's a short story. They also have reviews of podcasts and radio shows. There is a color piece in the middle, The Awakener, which just says part 1 of 2. So it's and then like a text story with just a little picture, another black and white one shot. Yeah, I just really think that it's a fun, if you like horror anthologies. I probably should have saved this for when Phil was on. This might be right up his jam. And, you know, book reviews, and then they take a Lovecraft poem and then just do little pictures by it. It's all a fun, just a fun sort of relic of that era and that sort of thing. And I think a worthy successor. I also like that while they're tied to the theme, they don't seem obsessive. You know what I mean? It's not like it all has to be strict Lovecraft, because The Witch Hunter isn't. So I think freeing yourself from that stricture, while having, you want to have a theme, because otherwise it could be anything. But yeah, they have this really cartoony style that's a horror one that's very much like the consorting with beasts and creating the weird hybrid type story that Lovecraft always seemed to have. And the little kid has to take on the monsters and everything. Yeah, it was just this fun, all these weird stories. Strange Aeons. You can find it online. If you like that type of... I don't know. It's always a crapshoot with... Like, I did let my subscription to Heavy Metal Apps. I enjoyed it, but it was just too much stuff. You know? They kind of stack up quickly.
And I thought, Grant Morrison taking over that Heavy Metal?
Yeah. And I thought, why don't I wait and do what I did with Dark Horse and then just wait for the ones that are really good to be collected and do an edition? Because they usually collect that stuff. And they still do the reprints. That's how I have a bunch of the Pat Mills. Like the LeDroit, the Vampire in Hell thing and all that stuff. That's all through Heavy Metal printings of the French comics.
You guys ever... I mean, I grew up with my sweet spot of comics, the golden age of comics for me being like the late 70s, early 80s, right? and that time was a time sort of like the second big wave resurgence time period for indie comics booming. With Pacific and First and Kimiko, all these companies popped up. Eclipse. It was the first time that, at you know, with the specialty shops popping up, the direct market, that I got to be exposed to some other books all on the same racks right next to the Big Two's books, all intertwined, all on the same tables, all on the same racks. So it's like, ooh, what's this? What's that? And I was of the mind to really pick up at least some of everything just to check it all out. I was certainly going to the comic store enough to... want to get something every time I went, and what am I going to try now? Is it going to be, like you said before, ElfQuest? I tried a couple issues of that, or this next book even, that I wonder if you guys have any relationship with at all. Back in the day, I just bought a couple of issues of it when it first came out, but that is Mike Baron and Steve Rude's Nexus.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. I have, I think I have some of the, one of the little collected... They've collected that in so many different formats.
Well,
I think I have
one of
the smaller, kind of collection. You know, that's physically, the dimensions are kind of
like a digest short. Kind of a thing.
Yeah, yeah, but a bit bigger. Like that, there's like that middle size. It's not quite full, but
the Dark Horse.
Yeah.
Well, I, other than reading those couple of issues, and then over the decades, just viewing some artwork. Never really got attached to the character. Never really read through many of his adventures at all. Again, just like I said, just those couple issues at the beginning. Kevin, you read any Nexus?
I believe I got one of the old trades. I read like maybe... I don't think it was like the beginning, but close enough. Like, wasn't it black and white or something? And
well, then it went times, color? At times, yep.
Well, yeah, well... Like, this wasn't the... It was early, but it was all in color, so I read, like, I think 6 issues. Didn't super, like, latch on to me, but I made sure to buy one of those, like, the first volume of the Dark Horse stuff, and still it sits on my shelf for another try, you know?
At the same time, I really like Steve Rude. I really like him as a creator. I really like the interviews I've heard with him and hear his passion about the industry, about art, about Jack Kirby, about his childhood and what comics meant to him, and about what they still mean to him to this day. And I really like his artwork. I really like Steve Rude's stuff, the stuff that he's done for the other companies, the pinups that I've seen. So why haven't I read more Nexus? I don't know. But I had the opportunity to pick up 4 issues of one of the Nexus revival comebacks that happened in 2007,
that was called Nexus Space Opera, from self-published from Rude Dude Productions.
And there was, I always love that name.
There's four issues, and Rude has some inkers like Gary Martin and Bob Wycheck, no slouch there, helping out on the book. But, boy, it is very, you know, the power of his pencils, all the time he puts into the designs of things like marketplaces and architecture and things is very Kirby-like. Not that the output is like Kirby in its design, but just in the effort and the intricacies, and it all is very Steve Rudy to me. And the deal with Nexus is that he's just this souped-up, powered dude who is an executioner of, like, of tyrants. And when he frees up, when he liberates people, oftentimes there's no place for them to go, or they're refugees of a destroyed society that had done them wrong or whatever. So he's been sort of collecting refugees to live on the planetoid area that he controls, which is his paradise called Ilum. Sort of like Asylum, but just the end of it, Ilum. And as more and more people, and as the decades of these stories are going on, there's more of a variety of species that are on this, in this culture now. And he's dealing with some, you know, now they can really introduce some societal problems and issues, and sort of see how they pop up for Nexus, who isn't just trying to punch out the bad guy, but trying to do what's right for this civilization that he can control, which is cool. And so this space opera thing is about, like, one of the factions on Ilum making trouble politically, making trouble physically, making threats, not wanting to assimilate. It starts to border into, like Muslim extremism type parallels. They end up strapping bombs to themselves and doing some, like, terrorist acts and whatnot. And Nexus decides these people have to go. And it's a hard decision because everyone's welcome here, but it's like everyone's welcome here to be peaceful. These people are not being peaceful, so they gotta go. And then it pisses off the places in the galaxy that these people come from. And then they're all, like, coming their armada, and they're gonna destroy Ilum. And now what does Nexus do when dealing with this threat? At the same time, his wife or partner, Sundra, they have an infant baby. And part of the goal of these bad guys is to kill the baby and take the baby and to depower, dethrone Nexus. I found it to be very enjoyable that I slowed down and actually gave it a good read. And what made me interested in doing so is that Nexus has popped up recently because there's some current Nexus stuff going on. There's been yet another revival. And Steve Rude has been putting out, and you should check out steverude.com, I believe is how what his website is, but certainly if you look him up, you'll find his homepage. But he's making newspaper-sized Nexus strips, like one-page strips that are coming out like every week or every other week or something like that, and he's doing both mailing it out and doing it digitally, and it's a neat way to be doing the serial. And certainly if you like big oversized, you know, Wednesday's Comics type old newspaper strip format, here's an opportunity to have Nexus real big. And it's a cool concept, it's cool art, and it's neat that he's still doing these stories to this day. This one was a good one, though.
Yeah, I think that makes sense for Nexus to be dealing with stuff like that. Because if I'm not mistaken, wasn't some of the stuff when it was originally coming out, it was like about the Soviet Union and
right
stuff like that.
Yep,
like dealing with those issues.
Yeah, he kind of to back up what Steve said. I was never a big fan, but he was a very strong artist, and that boom was pretty uneven. Like there was a lot of great stuff, but there was also a lot of sort of quickly put out books by new people that didn't have the kind of chops he had even back in the day. So that's what made him stand out quite a bit, was he was really, really a sharp talent.
Well, that's always the double-edged sword with, like, indie comics. Like, as much as they say, we can do anything, it's like sometimes, like, that can come back to bite you.
Well, I think that was that's a pretty good batch of indie comics, gentlemen.
Indeed.
Indeed. That's if you turn indie into a verb and have it in the past tense. But much like the past tense, this episode is the past tense. We want to thank you all for tuning in. And be sure to visit our sponsors, Nobody. And be sure to keep reading those indie comics.
And if you see Phil, no, we'll track him down for next episode.
Yes, more Phil. Hard Phil 1.